Hello, this is Kathleen, and today, Thursday, April 9th, I'll be reading to you from the Daily News of Newburyport. A collaborative effort. Local leaders, residents, gather at Waste Refuge Reduction Workshop by Caitlin D. Amesbury. Local leaders, residents, and members of the private sector gathered at the old Amesbury City Hall on Wednesday morning to discuss the future of waste reduction in their communities. The workshop, hosted by the Alliance of Climate and Environmental Stewards, ACES, a Newburyport-based nonprofit, was attended by members of area communities like Amesbury, Newburyport, Newbury, West Newbury, Rowley, and Merrimack. The third in a series, Wednesday's gathering allowed attendees to come together and brainstorm plans for how to tackle waste reduction in their communities through a 12-month action plan. Waste reduction is a pressing topic throughout the state, with the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection issuing a 2030 Solid Waste Master Plan that established a goal to reduce disposable statewide by 30% from 5.7 million tons in 2018 to 4 million tons in 2030, the state's website said. During the workshop, attendees brainstormed different ways to reach the goal, with the objectives ranging from community to community, Lindsay Haight, an ACES volunteer team member, said. For some communities, they just need to establish policies or guidelines or establish a team. Every community here, we hope, will leave this series with an assigned team of people who are visionaries, who are the doers, who are the trackers, a sustainability action team, she said. Specifically, Haight said some communities, like Newburyport, have already piloted waste reduction programs, while others are in the earlier stages. A lot of communities are talking about how we can divert solid waste out of the landfills by sending it to composting or sending it to recycling. And then other communities have been working on it for a long time, she said. Newburyport Mayor Sean Reardon, who was in attendance, said having conversations about waste reduction is crucial and that eventually municipalities may need to collaborate. I think it's really important, and I think a lot of us are in the same boat, even though we might need to be in different spots as far as what we're already doing in our cities or towns. But I do think, as we move forward, I think a lot of these things we're going to have to think regionally to really get some results on, he said. Also present was Amesbury Mayor Cassandra Gove, who said she was glad to be able to chat with involved parties about the topics. I think this is a really important conversation for us to have. It is an opportunity to bring together some really important stakeholders, both from within our community and from the region. It is a chance for us to have a conversation that we need to have, but don't have the time on an average workday to really think about strategically and cross-departmentally, she said. Haight also said that she was happy to see people from multiple communities in attendance and participating in engaged discussions. I think it is really commendable that in the enthusiasm that each of these communities has brought to this process, she said. Now attendees will go back to their communities before eventually reconvening as a group at least 1 year from now. Popular Port Minister stepping down in June. The Reverend Rebecca Bryan preparing for a new chapter by Matt Petrie. Newburyport. After 8 years of serving as a spiritual and moral pillar of the community, the Reverend Rebecca Bryan of First Religious Society Unitarian Universalist FRSUU Church is moving on. Brian, who is stepping down in June, has begun saying her goodbyes to the community as she prepares to begin a new chapter of ministry work. I think it just got clear for me anyway that my own life in ministry is continuing to evolve, Brian said, and that also the work we did together was good. A party celebrating Brian's time at the church is set for June 2nd at the Newburyport Senior Community Center, beginning at 5:30 p.m. I hope people come, Brian said. I hope people come to services over the next couple of months and join us. Don't be strangers. Brian came to the church in 2018 after serving a 2.5-year ministry in Brookline, hoping to find a place she could call home. This was it, Brian said. Over the years, Brian has become a fixture in the community, appearing at local memorials, flag raisings, and dozens of other occasions, while helping to expand the church's outreach efforts. As recently as last week, Brian was one of dozens who watched as Mayor Sean Reardon raised a transgender flag outside City Hall to recognize International Transgender Day of Visibility. Reardon on Wednesday called Brian's departure a significant loss for our community. Throughout her time in Newburyport, she has been a passionate and unwavering advocate for so many important causes, including social justice, equality, LGBTQ plus rights, supports for the unhoused, addressing food insecurity, and providing care and guidance for refugees, Reardon said. Reardon went on to praise Brian as a champion and a steady, trusted presence, someone our community could always turn to. I am deeply grateful for the opportunity to get to know her and to work alongside her, Reardon said. When we lost the Reverend Helen Mergita in 2024, it was Reverend Rebecca who helped guide me and the city through that incredibly difficult time. Her compassion and her strength made a lasting impact. Mergita was struck and killed by a motorist across from City Hall while on her way to attend Reardon's State of the City address. FRSUU Board Chair Bob Higgins said Brian first informed them of her impending departure in September. He shared that he and Brian came to the church around the same time. "She's the only minister I've known," Higgins said. "I think for a lot of us, it's kind of hard to picture what it's going to be like with someone new and different." He said Brian has worked to grow the church outside of its four walls. "It's more of a presence in the community," Higgins said. One memory both Brian and Higgins discussed as particularly powerful was in hosting an Afghan family in the church parish hall for over 2 years. Just over 40 members of five families came to Newburyport from Afghanistan in late 2021 to early 2022, and local clergy were quick to offer food and shelter. Higgins said the idea to open the parish hall to the family had been entirely Brian's. While the family has since moved out, he said the congregation still offers them assistance. "I just give her a ton of credit for that," Higgins said. Asked what comes next for her, Brian said it will be a new phase of her ministry, though she is not yet sure what that will look like. "I will be moving down to the South Shore closer to some of the work that is meaningful to me around immigration and things. Some time to do spiritual direction writing," Brian said. "Doing ministry more in the public sphere, if you will. Certainly be more in nature and leading things there and guest preaching. And we'll see right where it all evolves as far as the longer term plan." Regarding what will happen following Brian's departure, Higgins said that the way their faith works is they will have an interim minister for 2 years. "They come in and they help us sort of figure out where we are as a church," Higgins said. Are we very different from where we were 8 years ago when we selected her? And what do we need at this stage of our growth, of that of our situation? Brian said she is grateful for her experiences in the city. I am truly honored to have been a part of this phase of this community's time, Brian said. So I thank everybody for their welcome and their support of the church and our partnerships that have grown together. Brian was expected to say more regarding her departure during today's appearance on local radio's The Morning Show. It should be available after broadcast at www.ncmhub.org by clicking on YouTube and then playlist and scrolling down. Amesbury Boat Ramp, official, more money needed for the project, by Caitlin D. Amesbury. Local officials are providing an update on the Washington Landing Maritime Facility Project as it nears the end of the site design development phase. During this phase of the project, it was determined that the original grant allocation of $840,000 from supportive coastal infrastructure and local maritime economic development planning grants through the Seaport Economic Council would not cover the cost of the project. The project includes replacing the boat ramp, installing a gangway and 100-foot finger dock for the boat ramp, facility and transient vessels, the addition of approximately 900 square feet of landside boardwalk area to support the future construction of a harbor master office and improvements to the parking area, and restoring the shoreline adjacent to the boat ramp. Amesbury Police Chief and Harbor Master Craig Bailey on Wednesday said the total cost is actually closer to $2.4 million, leaving the city in need of additional funding to construct the project as originally intended. So city officials went back to the Seaport Economic Council to discuss how they could remedy the situation. And it was proposed that the city write an amendment to the original grant to receive more funding, according to Bailey. Now the city is waiting to see whether or not it will be awarded the funded from the grant amendment to see the entirety of the project through. The project received its funding 2 years ago when the city was awarded the aforementioned grant to support potential economic development along the waterfront, the city said. Previously, the area had simply consisted of the ramp, but thanks to the grant, the city was able to start the process of developing it into something more, according to the city's senior project manager, Howard Snyder. This is Amesbury's only public access to the Merrimack River, and it's been serving informally after improvements at various times since the late 50s. Up until this initiative, it was really just a boat ramp, but the recent development on the adjoining parcel has brought an effort to make it more than just a place where someone drives down with a boat and puts it in, he said. After the city received the grant for the project, Merrimack Valley Transit, MEVA, reached out and asked if Amesbury was interested in being part of its zero-emission ferry project that will allow residents and visitors to travel along the Merrimack River and stop in multiple communities. As we moved forward and started building up our plan, MEVA reached out to us and said, "This is what we've got going on. This would make a great partnership," Bailey said. After researching the ferry system, the city decided to officially form a partnership with MEVA and use the gangway and finger dock component of the project to allow for the mooring and the dockage of the ferry in Amesbury. As we started to look more into it, we realized that it would in fact be a great partnership, Bailey said. Next, the project's waterfront engineer will begin permitting process, with the hope of starting construction in late 2027. Curious Traveler, Paul Revere's Other Ride, a 250th anniversary story, by C.J. Fitzwater. Now, here's a little story I have to tell about three bad brothers. You know so well, it started way back in history. The Beastie Boys on the rocky banks of the Piscataway River on a cold late fall day in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, before 4 months before the battles of Lexington and Concord, December 14, 1774, is where the American Revolution began. The long roll of the drummer's call had slowly grown in volume, boom, 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 ever since the end of the French and Indian War. That war had won all of the land east of the Mississippi to Great Britain. To pay off its heavy debts, the British Parliament enacted the Sugar Act, boom. Then came the Stamp Act, boom, boom, followed by the Townshend Act, which included the tax on tea, boom, boom, boom. With each new act, the drumbeat grew louder. Then came the Boston Massacre in 1770, and the drums swelled even more. In 1772, written into the permanent record of the Salisbury Town Records, after approval at a town meeting by freeholders and other inhabitants of Salisbury, was a report from the Committee of Correspondence that used words from John Locke, words similar to what would soon appear in the Declaration of Independence, that the most essential rights of mankind are life, liberty, and property. This was an open act of treason, but approved by vote at town meeting. Still, the pounding of the war drum continued. On the morning of December 14th, men were called together by the beating of a drum on the Portsmouth Parade, nearly a year after the Boston Tea Party had ignited 342 chests of the British East India Company's Bohea Tea, though similar tea parties may have predated Boston's, including two in Market Square in Newburyport. The drums kept pounding as men gathered from all parts of Portsmouth, with others arriving from as far as Dover, Exeter, and Rye. News had spread quickly the night before, carried by an express courier bearing a letter from Joseph Warren, leader of the Sons of Liberty. King George III had ordered an embargo on all gunpowder, cannons, and muskets entering the colonies, and further commanded that existing supplies, including the ones at Fort William and Mary, be seized by British troops. The paid express courier, Paul Revere, who earned 2 shillings for his ride, had departed the Green Tavern after receiving final instructions from his Masonic brethren, Samuel Adams and Joseph Warren. After crossing the Mystic River, he mounted a borrowed gray horse and set out toward the Piscataway, carrying word to gather men and secure the valuable munitions in preparation for war. In his 10th ride for the Liberty Cause, he traveled Salem Road through Lynn and Salem, continuing through Danvers, then along Boston Post Road, crossing the bridge over the Parker River from Rowley into Newbury. There were several ways to cross the Merrimack River. The most direct may have been down Fish Street, now State Street, to March's Ferry, crossing into Salisbury and continuing up Ferry Road. According to Salisbury Town Records, Captain March was granted a petition to operate the ferry in 1687. This route was more direct than the primary postal crossing at Carr's Island. Carr's Ferry would have landed at the end of Bay Road, now Jefferson Street, where an inn stood on Carr's Island, a convenient resting place for post riders traveling between Boston and Newburyport. From there, the road led to Ferry Lots Lane, which still exists today, much as it did in 1774, a narrow path running from the river to Mudknock Road, before continuing through Salisbury to Seabrook along Post Road, now Lafayette Road, and on to Portsmouth. Another possible crossing was the Amesbury Ferry, running from Moulton's Hill at the end of Old Ferry Road to what is now Alliance Park at the confluence of the Powwow and Merrimack Rivers. From there, the road to Portsmouth could be picked up nearby, leading through what was then West Salisbury, near Rocky Hill and up Main Street, toward the state line in Seabrook. Carr's Ferry was falling out of favor, and the Amesbury Ferry too far west, and with Revere's mission requiring discretion, March's Ferry remains the most logical route. It's possible that Paul Revere stopped in either Salisbury or Newburyport to rest and water his horse, based on the timing of his 60-mile ride. The countryside itself seemed to feel the steady beat of the drum, and Revere, already a growing figure in the Patriot cause, would have found willing hosts in any town along the way. He continued north along the Post Road, passing through stretches of farmland in the coastal countryside of New Hampshire, before arriving at the Portsmouth Parade. There, Revere ran into a loyalist and former Boston boatbuilder, William Torrey. Paul said howdy, he said hi, and asked where he might find William Cutts, head of the local committee of correspondence, an underground group of patriots who organized communication among leaders during the planning of the revolution. Revere located Cutts at Stoodley's Tavern, where he delivered the letter from Joseph Warren and relayed all he knew of British troops, who he said were on their way to secure the king's powder and munitions. This turned out to be the wrong intel. Torrey, however, carried word of Revere's arrival to Loyalist Governor John Wentworth, and the drumbeat thundered on. Boom! Hundreds of men answered the drummer's call, gathering in readiness to seize the valuable stores held at the aging fort, built into New Hampshire's granite at the mouth of the Piscataway River, 3 miles downriver from Portsmouth. Loyalists also arrived, including the governor's secretary, warning that such an act would be considered the highest act of treason against the crown. The warning went unheeded. The rebels set out for Fort William and Mary, which was defended by a small Loyalist force, though there remained the possibility that British regulars had already arrived to reinforce it. Men came by horse, on foot, and in flat-bottomed boats, scows and gundalows, crossing from Kittery and from Great Bay, from Durham and Dover. They were led by the future Governor John Langdon, a merchant who had lived in the fort his entire life. The fort itself was under the command of Royal Captain John Cochrane, who had been warned by Wentworth and had hastily reinforced his position. Langdon approached the entrance and informed Cochrane of the Patriots' intent to take the supplies. Cochrane refused, declaring that if any rebel attempted to come into the fort, their blood will be upon their hands, for I will fire upon you. The fort was soon surrounded. British defenders stood ready with cannon and muskets. At Langdon's order, the assault began. The rebels surged over the 6-foot walls as the steady beat of the drums, now joined by fifes, were the soundtrack of the chaos. Cochrane ordered the cannons fired, and though no one was struck, the moment sparked the first violent clash, the first shots fired of the American Revolution. The booty from the siege was substantial, some 100 barrels of gunpowder, enough to fire 5 million musket shots. The rebels quickly loaded the 100-pound barrels of powder onto their gundalows and, with the help of the incoming tide, carried it back up the Piscataway River to Great Bay, where it was carefully distributed. 29 barrels were sent to Exeter, 12 to Kingston, 8 each to Epping and Nottingham, and 4 to Portsmouth. An additional 25 barrels were hidden in a church in Durham. New Hampshire was now stocked. The rebels returned the following day, led by General John Sullivan, and captured 16 fine cannons with their carriages, along with cannonballs and dozens of muskets, pistols, and other weapons. These supplies would soon be used in the battles of Lexington and Concord, and later at the Battle of Bunker Hill. Paul Revere returned to Boston, a city now firmly under the weight of intolerable acts, which required local officials to provide housing for British soldiers. His more famous ride was yet to come. New Hampshire, meanwhile, would see no major battles of that war, or any war within its borders since. And still, the drum beats on. This story was inspired by the work and the writing of Joyce McKenna, thanks to Dana Eckelberger of Newburyport Public Library and Melinda Morrison, town clerk of Salisbury, for their help in research. I also referenced History of Newburyport, Massachusetts, by John J. Currier, The Paul Revere and Ride, and The Night That Saved America by Kostia Kennedy, and 1776 by David McCullough. Thanks for reading and supporting local journalism. Curious Traveler is a series of stories written by C.J. Fitzwater. If you're interested in meeting, sharing a meal, and telling your story, send him an email at cfitzwater@ymail.com. Library hosts art exhibit, Georgetown. The Georgetown Peabody Library is hosting Celebration of the Everyday, an art exhibit by Lisa Janelle in the library's meeting room. An artist reception will be held Saturday at 11 a.m. For more information on Janelle and her work, visit www.liisajanellestudio.com. Janelle is a local artist specializing in mixed media, collage, and mosaic. Her work is inspired by a strong connection to nature and by hanging out with her three grandchildren, whose sense of wonder provides a fresh perspective on the magic of everyday life. The library is located at 2 Maple Street. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you all have a safe and well day.